Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Celia Hatton. We begin with the latest from Syria and the fight for oil. The Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group in Syria, which overthrew the Assad regime several days ago, has been consolidating control. HTS says it's wrestled the eastern city of Deir ez-Zor and its oil reserves from Kurdish fighters. In about 20 minutes, we'll get the latest from northern Syria and what's happening there. But first, in the west of the country, anger unleashed as Syrian rebels set fire to the tomb of the ex-president Bashar al-Assad's father. Hafez al-Assad's gravesite was located in his former hometown in Latakia province. In the capital, Damascus, the new interim prime minister, Mohammed al-Bashir, is calling for stability and calm. He's asking for Syrians abroad to return home. Some hope for the future as those living there are adjusting to a new normal and businesses are reopening. One restaurant owner told the BBC he is hopeful.
We opened the shop because we wanted our lives back. We are happy that our country is safe again. I'm very optimistic. The country was full of injustice and oppression. That's over now.
Though another resident says she's concerned about what will happen next.
Life without Assad is beautiful, but we don't feel enough safe yet. We need to be more safe. I just need the things to quiet down. The children are afraid from all those arms, bullets in the air.
Well, let's go to Damascus now to speak with our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Lise, as I've been saying, we're hearing about people associated with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, are taking revenge on the Assad regime. What do we know?
Yes, and you also mentioned in your introductory remarks, Celia, about how they have now set fire to the tomb of Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, in the heartland of the family. I was able to get permission. After, it took a long time to get permission to visit that mausoleum several years ago. They held it in such reverence. They were so worried that any journalist would somehow demean it when they went to visit it. And it's a very, very striking tomb. And now the images we're seeing are in flames. And it's perhaps not surprising. It's only day three of the new rebel order and emotions are running high. And that is causing, as you mentioned, some revenge killings. There have been some grisly images on social media, which the BBC have verified. But the human rights activists, members of the rebels, they've been collating for years details on the henchmen of Assad. They are well known. So some very well-known figures have now been caught. And the rebels have been taking justice into their own hands. They've announced too that there's going to be a public execution this week, so that not only is justice to be done, you're hearing some celebratory gunfire, I think, but be seen to be done. They have a list. They call it the number one list of people who must be held accountable for their crimes. While at the same time, they had announced a general amnesty for everyone who doesn't have blood on their hands.
All this is happening as we're hearing a call from the new government for those living in exile to return home. What are the prospects of that?
Well, alongside what we've been discussing, the revenge killings, pulling down all of the symbols of the old regime, the new leadership, which is still dominated by Islamists, it has to be said, and that is worrying many Syrians, that they are trying to show that they can establish a stable, orderly transition. You know, I'm speaking to you, you can perhaps hear the traffic is flowing in the streets. They've kept the lights on, the shops are opening. I've just spent the morning in the old city and you can still feel the lightness and the joy in the air. Syrians saying that they're breathing freely for the first time in their lives. And there's a real excitement. And I have to say, Celia, all the Syrians I speak to, whether here in Syria or the ones abroad who very much want to come back, they cannot allow themselves to think that this is not going to work out. Everyone has suffered so much for so long, and they have dreamed and longed for years for an end to the brutal regime of President Assad. They have to believe that this is going to work out, and many are ready to do whatever they can to see that happen.
Lise, thank you. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, in Damascus. Well, as we've just heard from Lise, there are some signs that daily life is returning to normal in some parts of Syria. But what about the economy there? Syria is one of the poorest countries in the Middle East. 14 years of conflict and exodus of people and international sanctions have taken a heavy toll. Dr. Osama Kadi is a Syrian-Canadian economist. He worked inside Syria for a number of years, and he used to head the Syrian Economic Task Force, an independent think tank based in Damascus.
The Syrian economy is devastated, really, after like 13 to 14 years of revolution. Our GDP went down from $64 billion to less than $5 billion. Our general budget went down from $16 billion to $2 billion. We have poverty rate is really scary. We have 95% of the people under poverty line. Inflation-wise, we are talking about more than 3,000 to 4,000% over that 14 years of inflation. Infrastructure, industry, and agriculture have been severely damaged because we have half of the population flee. Many of the professionals and our human capital, human resources flee Syria. Just in 1 year, we lost 47,000 technicians and people who work with the industry. So actually, it's really, really damaged our economy big time.
Dr. Kadi, you paint a really grim picture. What's the potential for the Syrian economy to improve now? What does it have going for it?
We have to have the stability and security. That's number one. It's okay for now after like only 1 week of falling of the Assad regime. It's really, I would say, is very bright picture, you know, relatively speaking, you know, usually with the revolution. And after 1 week will be big chaos where we have very, very peaceful transition of power, which is great. We need like economic reform big time, a shift toward a market-oriented economy, encouraging private sector growth and foreign investment. We have to really focus on our infrastructure, reconstruction. Even I'm sometimes against the word rebuilding Syria because it gives the impression that we have a really good economy and good infrastructure before 2011, while we were really having very bad infrastructure even before 2011. So we really need rehabilitation of critical infrastructure, roads, bridges, and utilities.
Dr. Kadi, you mentioned the mass exodus of people in the years leading up until now. There have been calls for Syrians in exile to now return. What could human capital do? Could that really reinvigorate the economy?
Especially if it comes with international support. You know, we need assistance from the international community to support these reconstruction and economic development efforts, which they create jobs for those people, help them out to rebuild their destroyed houses. We have to have really good urban development planning from now on. So we really build our cities in highly international standard.
Your NGO presented data to Bashar al-Assad before his regime toppled. How was it received back then?
Actually, he ignored all reports, all advice. We used to have Syria 2025 plan, a long, long report, two volumes, big ones. And he ignored all of recommendations. And in 2005, I submitted an unemployment report because we used to have 20% unemployment. That's in 2004. A third of the population under poverty line in 2004, 2005. But he ignored all of them. And I mean, I think I'm not the exception because all advisors give him tons of advice. But he actually insists of going through his own corrupt channels besides security channels. So he actually really was give us like a deaf ear for all advice.
analysis from the economist Dr. Omar Khadi. Well, now to the southern Syria, to the city of Dara. That's where early in the protests against Bashar al-Assad back in 2011, a group of teenage boys were arrested and tortured for putting up anti-government graffiti. The mutilated body of 13-year-old Hamza al-Khatib was later returned to his family, sparking widespread protests that drew harsh crackdowns from government forces. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to Dara to meet Hamza's mother and the new military leader there.
While Dara was celebrating on Sunday, Samira al-Khatib was waiting and hoping. If anyone should be happy at the fall of Bashar al-Assad, it's her. The mutilated body of her 13-year-old son, Hamza, was returned by Assad's forces in 2011, weeks after his arrest at an anti-government protest. But Samira isn't celebrating. Today, she learnt that another son, Omar, arrested in 2019, had also died in custody. Confirmed in files from the notorious Said Naya prison, released on social media by people desperately searching for their relatives. Shaking with grief, Samira called on God to exact revenge on Bashar al-Assad. I ask God to afflict him and his children with what afflicted my children, she said. I hope he'll pay the price. This area was a key opposition heartland. Since Sunday, Ahmed al-Alda has been the military leader here, an English literature graduate who became an army officer and then a rebel fighter. He told me he entered Damascus alongside other rebel groups on Sunday, moving embassy staff and civilian government workers to the Four Seasons Hotel and protecting them.
I don't want to punish them because they choose to be with Bashar al-Assad. They are Syrian. But I want to give them a message that we are a human being. We are not animals, as Bashar al-Assad said, that criminal. And I promised them that I will do my best to bring him to the judgment because we will not forget what he did to the Syrian people, the Syrian children, how he destroyed Syria.
The opposition in this southern part of Syria is different to the alliance led by the Islamist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which swept down from the north last week. With their common enemy gone, the challenge now is to find a common vision. The war with Assad has ended, but peace in Syria has not yet been won.
Lucy Williamson in Dara. Coming up, the Kurds of northern Syria enjoyed quite a lot of independence during Assad's rule. So what's been happening as his regime fell?
Well, as the rebel marched towards Damascus, Kurdish fighters, he lost a battle against rebel groups close to Aleppo, and thousands of Kurds were displaced from this battle. And yesterday, Turkish-backed rebels took another town called Manbij from Kurdish-backed fighters. So the Kurds have been a major ally for the U.S. in the fight against ISIS. But now with this new rebel advances, they have been slowly pushed back.
That's coming up in 15 minutes' time. A reminder of our other top story this hour. Rebel fighters in Syria have set fire to the tomb of the ousted president Bashar al-Assad's father, while the interim president has urged Syrian refugees around the world to return home. You're listening to NewsHour. To South Korea now. Pressure continues to mount on the president in South Korea after his short-lived attempt to impose martial law last week. Police have raided the offices of Yoon Suk-yeol, and some of his top officials and military commanders have been arrested over their alleged role in enforcing the martial law order. A standoff lasting several hours took place between police and officials at the presidential office who appeared to be attempting to stop police from seizing evidence. The spokesman for the opposition Democratic Party, Jo Seung Lai, told journalists that President Yoon and the officials helping him were breaking the law.
What the Office of the President and the Secret Service are protecting right now is not a head of state, but an insurgent. Therefore, interfering with the police raid constitutes participation in the insurrection by protecting the insurgents.
A short while ago, I spoke with our correspondent Jean McKenzie in Seoul.
Today, police officers have tried to raid the president's office. They've been there to try and get hold of the minutes of the meetings, two crucial meetings that he held, one before he decided to impose martial law in the minutes beforehand, and then meetings he held in the very small period of time that martial law was in effect here back last Tuesday night. But it's been a bit of a standoff between the police and the president's office security officials. So they were able to get into the presidential compound, but they haven't been able to conduct the searches that they wanted to. We've just heard, actually, Celia, in the last few minutes that the officers have left the compound after about 8 hours. They haven't been able to get the material they wanted. They apparently got some little fraction of information, but not what they were looking for. And the presidential office has been saying today that actually there are no minutes of these meetings. But this is reflective of a much bigger investigation or bigger set of investigations against the president that's ongoing. He's now being investigated from so many different angles. You've got a police investigation, prosecutors, corruption officials are looking into him. The opposition have managed to get an independent investigation. So you really get the sense now that this legal sort of net is closing in on him.
Indeed, the pressure is mounting on all of those, Yoon and those around him who took part in declaring martial law. We're hearing the former defense minister tried to kill himself.
Yeah, so the former defense minister is the most senior high-ranking official that has been implicated in this so far that's actually been arrested. He was in custody. Now, he is seen as playing quite a key role in implementing this martial law, and he'd actually come out and taken responsibilities for some of the chaos that has ensued. He was in prison, and we heard from the Justice Ministry this morning that he had tried to take his own life. He was transferred to hospital, and he is said to be fine now, but yeah.
What are the prospects, Jean, for an impeachment vote against the president? We saw last weekend an impeachment motion put forward by the opposition. It failed because the ruling party boycotted that vote. But does it look like it might have a chance of succeeding if the opposition tries again?
At the moment, the ruling party here is in total disarray, honestly. It just doesn't know what to do next. I've been speaking to a couple of the lawmakers, and they say it's just, there is no kind of agreed position on what on earth they're going to do. The party is so divided right now. You have this faction who does not want to impeach the president, right? They want to hold out. They want the president to resign himself. They think if they impeach him, they are committing political suicide. They're not going to be re-elected themselves. The people in their party will not forgive them. That's where they're at, and that is why they don't want to impeach the president. But there are this handful coming around and thinking that impeachment is inevitable, really. They see the public anger. They see the tens of thousands of people on the street, not just on Saturday, but every single night. And they realise that this is going to have to happen. But there's a really interesting dynamic here this week. It's that this very strange power vacuum at the top of the government, because it's really not clear what authority the president has anymore. The prime minister came out at the weekend and said that actually, the president, he's not going to be running the country anymore. Actually, I'm going to be taking some of the key decisions. But that's kind of left people scratching their heads, because there's actually no legal framework for the prime minister to be able to take over the running of the country unless the president is incapacitated, which hasn't happened. So everybody has been asking, well, look, who is running the country at the moment? And we don't seem to be able to get a clear answer on that. So that is paralysing a lot of decision making.
Jean McKenzie speaking to us from Seoul. Well, let's talk about whales, specifically male humpback whales, who are known for their mating songs like this. Whales usually go on the move in order to look for food or find a mate. Now, researchers now say that one humpback male appears to have made one of the longest and most unusual migrations ever recorded. The whale was first spotted in 2017 off the Pacific Ocean off Colombia. It then popped up several years later near Zanzibar in the Indian Ocean, a distance of at least 13,000 kilometers. That's more than 8,000 miles. Or for more, let's hear from Ekaterina Kashinakova from the Tanzania Cetaceans Program. She's in Montenegro. I began by asking her how unusual this kind of distance really is for a humpback whale.
This species is highly migratory, but they are quite loyal to the initial breeding grounds and the feeding grounds. So they do indeed cover a huge amount of kilometers. They cover thousands of kilometers on one-way migration, moving in between the breeding areas and the foraging areas, but they do not normally change their ocean basins. And this particular individual not only went to completely different breeding grounds, but also skipped on its way or visited in between to another different breeding grounds, which is West Atlantic and the East Atlantic. So basically relocating from the East Pacific, visiting in between West Atlantic, East Atlantic, and finally arriving to the Western Indian Ocean. So this is longitudinal movement is rather unusual for these otherwise highly migratory species.
So he visited a few different breeding grounds. Is he sort of like the equivalent of a humpback whale Casanova?
It is, yes. And the different breeding grounds are well-defined for different populations, but the exchange between such a faraway breeding grounds, that's really, really unusual. And when we have seen the result, automatic recognition of the happy whale, we couldn't believe our eyes. We thought there is an error. And then we had to look without this platform. It wouldn't have crossed our mind to cross-check our Tanzanian catalog with Colombian catalog because the populations are so far away, and there was no that knowledge that this even was possible. So that was because of this fantastic technology that is now available to anyone, basically. We were able to identify that lone traveler.
Any idea why this whale might have traveled so far? Does it have anything to do with climate change, for example?
Climate change might play a role, yes, because it's been demonstrated by other research that global climatic changes do affect the krill mass, biomass, and distribution in the foraging areas in the Southern Sea, which may in turn force the animals to different foraging grounds in the still same area, but going further. He probably followed the other animals from different populations and ended up in different breeding grounds.
And lastly, Katerina, you've been focusing on the movements of this whale. Have you named him?
A lot of animals are being named. We haven't yet, but probably we should. And if I wanted to pick a name for him, I would say we could name him Skull because of the pigmentation pattern that is looking very much like a skull on the ventral side of his tail. Even his dorsal fin is quite distinctive. And we also used the photographs of the dorsal fin to confirm that that's exactly the same individual that has been seen in Colombia and in Tanzania. Because luckily, we not only had photographs of its fluke, but we also had photographs of the dorsal fin. So that helped us to understand that it's 100% the same individual.
Yekaterina Kolesnikova of the Tanzania Cetaceans Program, speaking to us from Montenegro. This is NewsHour coming to you live from London. Well, a lawyer for Luigi Mangione, who's accused of murdering a health insurance executive in New York, says his client will plead not guilty. Mr. Mangione is also fighting an extradition order to New York from Pennsylvania, where he was arrested. Before his hearing yesterday, he shouted to reporters.
Luigi, do it. It's completely out of justice. And it's an insult to the intelligence of the American people.
The BBC's John Sudworth joins us live from New York. John, he shouted to reporters. What happened?
Yeah, so this was when he was being taken into court in the full view of the assembled press. Obviously, a huge amount of media interest in this case. And as he was being walked in handcuffs, he was able to turn, and as you heard there, there was this outburst. You can hear the words, "This is an insult to the intelligence of the American people." No sort of specific clear idea of what he's referring to there. But of course, the speculation is that he is talking in general terms about the concerns over the way that people are treated by healthcare companies, which is all part of the speculation as to the motive here.
I mean, indeed, this murder, I mean, it does involve the murder of an unarmed man, but he was also the CEO of a health insurance provider. And his killing has tipped off a much wider discussion about the power of these insurance companies.
It has, almost immediately in the wake of the shooting last week, online discussion, social media was full of people venting their own anger about, allegations that they've been unfairly treated by insurance providers, had claims denied. Those concerns have been there for a long time, long running, but this shooting does seem to have brought them to the fore. Now, obviously, there is a concern certainly from the police's point of view that, there is a difference between, discussing issues around this case and being seen, as some of the social media has been, to be sort of celebrating this killing. And I say that as being a concern of the police, in the sense that they are openly saying they are being vigilant of the possibility of some sort of risk of further violence, that this in some way inflames the situation. So, those issues are absolutely part of the context of the case. We ought to say, though, at this stage, of course, we are in very early stages of these proceedings. These are extradition hearings that are happening about bringing this suspect back to New York. And we do not yet have any official confirmation from him or in terms of any kind of trial testimony as to what his mindset was or what his real motivations were.
Okay, John, thank you. Thanks for taking us through that. The BBC's John Sudworth speaking to us from New York. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service. Well, let's return to events inside Syria. The HTS rebel group, which overthrew the Assad government, says it's taken control of the eastern city of Deir ez-Zor and its oil reserves. A spokesman said U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters had withdrawn from the area. A senior figure in the Kurdish self-governing north and east of Syria, Salah Muslim, had told the BBC that Kurds have no problem with the new Islamist authorities in Damascus. But he said Turkey was creating problems in the region. He said it wanted to recreate an empire.
Turkey is involved directly in this fighting. I mean, their planes are bombing many places, in north of Syria. So they have some expansionist dreams, to make a new Ottoman Empire. This is their policies, and they are involved in the Syrian issues from the beginning. I am talking about maybe more than 15 years.
So what now for the Kurds, a sizable minority in northern Syria? That's a question I put to Vladimir van Wildenberg, a Dutch journalist in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. He's the author of The Kurds of Northern Syria.
Well, as the rebel marched towards Damascus, Kurdish fighters, they lost a battle against rebel groups close to Aleppo, and thousands of Kurds were displaced from this battle. And yesterday, Turkish-backed rebels took another town called Manbij from Kurdish-backed fighters. So the Kurds have been a major ally for the U.S. in the fight against ISIS. But now with this new rebel advances, they have been slowly pushed back.
And what about the latest from the eastern city of Deir ez-Zor?
Well, the Kurds, after the regime and Iranian-backed militias left Deir ez-Zor, they moved into these towns, they said, to prevent ISIS from taking advantage of the instability. They took the city of Deir ez-Zor and one important border crossing. But recently, because there were protests by local Arabs that didn't want to have Kurdish rule over their cities, they pulled out from these cities, and they are now back to the original locations they were in eastern Deir ez-Zor. They still control the major oil and gas resources of Syria, and they are located in northern Syria, northeast Syria, to be more exact.
So looking forward, what are they worried about now?
They're worried about two things. First of all, you now have a new transitional government in Damascus. Will this new government accept any form of Kurdish autonomy, or will they crack down on the Kurds in the future? Another concern is they have, as I mentioned before, that the Kurds were a major ally for the U.S. against ISIS. So there's around 900 U.S. troops in northern Syria. So what they are worried about is that the Trump administration that will be in place in January they're afraid that he would withdraw troops from northern Syria. So far, that's not really clear. But if that happens, then they will be left alone and they will be vulnerable for attacks by rebel groups and Turkey. So they're worried about the future. They don't know exactly what is going to happen to them.
Have we had any indications from the incoming Trump administration as to what they might do?
It's very unclear until now, but when the Assad regime was falling, he made a tweet saying that U.S. has nothing to do with Syria and they should stay out of it. So maybe that's an indication that he doesn't want to have anything to do with Syria. But of course, I mean, we have to see, because the new Trump administration most likely will focus first on domestic issues and not immediately on a difficult subject like the Middle East. But Turkey is lobbying in the U.S. They're trying to convince the Trump administration that they have to withdraw from Syria. But there's also many voices that it's not a good idea to withdraw, because the Kurds, they have like 50,000 ISIS families that are under Kurdish control. And also there's many ISIS prisoners in Kurdish prisons. So there are worries that if the U.S. would pull out, these prisoners and families, they could escape and they could create like a second ISIS regeneration, basically.
That was Vladimir van Vilkenberg in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. Let's hear more about those camps that Vladimir just mentioned. I spoke to Azadeh Mouveni. She's an associate professor of journalism at New York University, and she's the author of Guesthouse for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. She's visited the camps and interviewed people there, and I asked her to tell us what we know about the camps and who's in them.
There is one very large camp that's called El Hol and a smaller one called Roj. These are essentially detention centers. I mean, they're heavily guarded. There's barbed wire. They are full of women and children. There's a separate network of detention centers, about 26 of them, which hold male fighters. These are very hybrid populations. They include trafficked victims of ISIS who joined the group or were groomed to join the group as teenagers, Yazidi survivors of the genocide, many foreigners. They encompass 51 different nationalities from around the world. These are family members of fighters who joined ISIS, maybe people, women who were involved in the group itself. And then there's also pockets, like large communities of Syrians and Iraqis whose affiliation with ISIS hasn't been quite worked out yet. They haven't been reintegrated into their communities. These are very violent places because there are cells of hardcore ISIS supporters. There are stabbings in these places. There are tent burnings. There's a generation of children. There are thousands of children in these camps who have grown up in them. They've never been in formal education. They've never been socialized. So it's just, from a security perspective, ethically, like a tinderbox, these places.
That's quite a graphic description. What's the future of these camps now?
The future of these camps is a big international security problem. I mean, these 51 countries that I mentioned who have nationals in these camps have largely washed their hands of them. No one wants to be repatriating ISIS-affiliated women and children, certainly not in Europe. It's electorally hugely unpopular. It's just been a long-term problem that's been resolved by having these Syrian Kurds, the Syrian Democratic Forces, essentially cope with the problem on behalf of the international community. Britain and the U.S. have spent a lot of money improving security for these facilities. They know exactly who's inside. So the real question is, what happens now when this northeast segment of Syria that's been sort of outsourced to the Syrian Democratic Forces, the STF, is now going to be at the center of a new proxy battle with the Islamists of HTS, backed by Turkey? So we're looking at an incredibly precarious situation where Turkey will most likely, or seems poised to want to try and crush the SDF using its Islamist proxies and HTS. And that will be pushed back against and try to be blocked by the supporters of the SDF, which are a strange alliance. The Israelis are trying to sort of affiliate with them and back them. The U.S., of course, which pays them to manage these camps. And the Iranians also have decent relations with these camps. So what we're looking at is the potential for civil war in Syria, chaos, as just a new set of external actors are positioned to fight over territory and influence with these camps as a sort of bargaining chip in the middle.
Is there a risk of ISIS reemergence in all of this?
Well, there have been pockets of ISIS in nether regions of Syria and northern Iraq ever since the caliphate collapsed in 2018. I mean, they've been largely confined to very limited locations. The U.S. has maintained a troop presence. The real concern would be that if these camps are collapsed, if the SDF decides that it cannot manage them anymore, if they open the doors to these camps, suddenly you have a very different situation where you have very hardcore ISIS fighters and supportive family members who would stream out of these camps, would sort of reassemble with ISIS elements in these nether regions. And then we face actually, I think, a potential for renewed resilience by the group. And that's the nightmare scenario.
Azadeh Mouveni, Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University. According to a UN report published today, there's been a rise in the detection of human trafficking victims compared to pre-pandemic levels. The majority of these are women and girls who are mostly trafficked for the purpose of sexual exploitation. Thousands of these victims are trafficked into Europe via Spain. The BBC 100 Women team followed one elite unit of police detectives as they rescue women and help them rebuild their lives. The BBC's Blanca Muñoz reports.
Hola, ¿qué tal? ¿Cómo va todo?
It all starts with a friendly voice on the phone, offering you an opportunity when you need it the most. When you realize what's going on, it's too late. Life will never be the same. For Victoria, this moment came when she first saw the room where she would spend the next 3 years. It was the metal lock on the door that made her shiver.
I was shocked. I started to cry and begged her to let me go.
The trafficker who had lured Victoria to Spain from Colombia responded with two simple words. No way. Spain is both a transit country and often the final destination for thousands of victims, mainly from Latin America and Africa, who are trafficked into Europe. Instead of starting her promised job as a cleaner, Victoria was immediately forced into prostitution.
I had to sleep with my makeup on, and you always had to be in your underwear, ready for any customer who will arrive.
Victoria lived with the fear that no one would come to save her. An elite team of mainly female investigators was already on her trafficker's trail. At a secret location, in the middle of the night, the police is preparing to raid a property where a gang is suspected to hide their victims. Cristina is part of an elite unit of Guardia Civil detectives who fight organized crime and rescue traffic victims.
It's minutes, seconds even, before you can enter the property, but it feels like an eternity.
The team's investigation shows that sex trafficking has gone farther underground after the pandemic, with most victims now kept in private apartments supplied by criminal gangs. The state of these flats affects even experienced investigators like Cristina.
You are ready to throw away the clothes you wear during a raid, as you won't be able to wash the smell off. It's so distressing, and the stench often makes you sick.
Her deputy, Lydia, agrees.
When you go inside these flats and see the conditions in which victims had to work and live for so long, it's terrifying.
It was Cristina and Lydia's team who rescued Victoria from one of these flats a few years ago. We can't give details of her rescue, because as a protected witness, we need to conceal her identity. But Victoria remembers it was a sunny morning.
I look at them, hug them, and cried. I go out on the street and breathe, and I say, my God, thank you, I'm alive. I feel free, and that's the best feeling.
You can watch the BBC 100 Women documentary Raid on the Brothel Next Door on the BBC World Service YouTube channel from Saturday, the 14th of December. More from the latest season from 100 Women is also available on the BBC News website. You can have a look for it there. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from London. You're listening to NewsHour. Let's go back to our top story, the fast-moving story inside Syria. Israel says it's carried out hundreds of airstrikes and hit most strategic weapon stockpiles inside Syria to stop them falling into the hands of jihadists. The Israeli military said it had destroyed Syria's naval fleet, as well as helicopters, air defense systems and tanks. At a news conference, a spokesperson for the United Nations, Stéphane Dujarric, said the UN wanted to see an end to the attacks.
It is very clear that we stand against any violation of the territorial integrity of Syria. We are against these types of attacks. I think this is a turning point for Syria. It should not be used by its neighbors to encroach on the territory of Syria. It should be used by all those in the region and beyond to support the Syrian people so they can choose their own path.
The UN is pushing for the new rulers of Syria to be given time to reveal themselves and their intentions to the world. But Israel suggests it's acting preemptively to stop dangerous weapons getting into the hands of people who might use them. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been in and out of Syria for decades. On his latest visit, he crossed into the country just hours after the Assad regime was toppled. And for the first time for many years, he says it's a place where people can talk openly and be heard by the outside world.
We're just going past a very tattered, shot-up checkpoint. There's still a bit of a portrait of Bashar al-Assad and his father, and there are men in civilian clothes or bits of uniform, rebels, in charge now, waving us through, shaking hands with the driver, all very happy, thumbs up. I'm starting to realise fully that the regime has gone. I mean, I kind of knew it, but having been here so many times when the place was essentially under the jackboot of the Assad family, it's quite a scene.
Tamam.
It's Remy Martin XF. That's like $200 a bottle. Well, at the Syrian border terminal, there was a really fancy duty-free shop, and I'm in it now. The steel shutter has been ripped up. There's massive amount of debris outside. And initially, I thought it was theft, or there may have been a bit of that, but there are a lot of broken bottles of very expensive spirits, whiskey, fancy brandies, and things like that. So this may have been Islamists getting rid of alcohol, which they don't agree with, and actually, if I smell the smell here in the lobby of the building, it absolutely stinks of alcohol. So they've been just, I think, opening the bottles and emptying them. So I've come to an area called Meze 86, and I wanted to come back here because in all the years of the regime, this was one of the hot spots of loyalty to the Assad family. Why? Because a majority of the people who lived around here were from their own Alawite community, and it was families supported by men, basically, who carried guns for the regime, who were in the military, who were in one of the many intelligence agencies much feared by the wider population, and the atmosphere has changed. The Assad posters have gone. I'm near the rubbish heap. There are army boots on it. There are uniforms. There's a flak jacket. All of them chucked away, and I've been talking to a woman here called Safa al-Safadi, who she tells me her neighbours, her former neighbours, they're not here anymore.
They all left. I live on top of this building. I can see from the top. They all left. When the FSA arrived, they left.
How is life now without Assad?
Tamam, حلوة.
Yeah, beautiful?
Beautiful, yes. Beautiful.
Why beautiful?
Life without Assad is beautiful, but we don't feel enough safe yet. We need to be more safe.
What would you like to have to make you feel safer?
I just need the things to quiet down. The children are afraid from all those arms, bullets in the air, and that's it.
Right now, Damascus seems like a calm city. Let's hope it stays that way. We've stopped for a bite to eat at a shawarma takeaway, which for years and years I've been coming to when I've been here. And the guys here say that they're actually the first day they've been back. They were closed for a couple of days, but now they're here and they're doing business. It's a sign, I guess, of some return to normalcy. Why did you decide to reopen today? You've been closed for a couple of days.
We opened the shop because we wanted our lives back. We are happy that our country is safe again.
What about the future? Are you feeling positive or are you a bit worried?
I'm very optimistic. Very optimistic. We couldn't express ourselves openly before. The country was full of injustice and oppression. That's over now.
The fire brigade have come, and there's a lot of smoke coming from the building, which is shuttered. What's happened here is that this is a mobile phone shop that was looted a couple of days ago. I can see the broken glass. And today, someone has got in there and has set a fire and is trying to burn it down. Why did they hate this place so much? Well, it's called Emma Tel Co. It's named after Asma al-Assad, the wife of Bashar. Emma was, I think, the name she was known as when she was growing up and going to school in England. And they want to get rid of it. Any connection with the family, it's got to go. I've been driving around for a couple of hours, and what are my impressions? Well, this is a city that feels like it's coming back to life. I'm told that yesterday shops were shut, the streets were empty. Well, they're open today and there are people around. Another conclusion, people are willing to talk in a way that it just wasn't possible in all the visits I made here during the many years of the Assads. There's a sense of optimism, I think, among people, but also a realization that it's not necessarily going to be easy. They know their history. They know the region. They realize that bad things can happen and often do. But for now, for today, oh, I've seen a lot of people smiling and laughing, and you didn't always get that when you stuck a microphone in their face here in Damascus, in the days of the Assad family.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, gives us a view from the ground in Syria. We've come to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team, thanks for listening.